It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll learn the best ways to make barbecue chicken for your next backyard cookout with the help of Barbecue Hall of Famer and friend of Central Time, Meathead. First, the latest data from the State Department of Health Services says infant mortality rates among African Americans are more than double the state average. The department is also now seeking public input on how to spend a nearly $15 million settlement from e-cigarette manufacturer Juul Labs. We have the DHS secretary designee with us for a look at those issues, along with health advisories, budget reaction, and the state of the opioid epidemic here in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for the Health Services Department chief? How should the state spend its resources to lower infant mortality? Have you seen the impact of the opioid epidemic in your own community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kirsten Johnson heads the State Department of Health Services. Secretary Johnson, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you for having me.
It's been just about 5 months now since Governor Evers appointed you to head that agency. What are your impressions now that the early days are past you?
That's a great question. I'm going to say that it's still early days. DHS is a very large agency, and you know, I've spent the last few months really learning sort of the depth and the breadth of our work. Certainly, we've been deep into the budget negotiations, and you know, it's been really fascinating. But I think my first impressions really are that there's a tremendous team of smart and really dedicated staff at DHS who are doing just great work to keep Wisconsinites healthy.
Let's do a little civics 101. What does DHS do? What's the scope of the job there?
That's a great question, too. So a number of things. We have the Division of Public Health. So pre-pandemic, I think many people didn't know what public health did or where public health lived. But, you know, we have local public health departments across the state and counties and cities and municipalities. But DHS also has this Division of Public Health that works closely with those health departments. We also have the Division of Medicaid Services, so that's Medicaid. All of Medicaid lives within DHS. We also have DCPS, which really is focused on behavioral health, and we have 7 different facilities across the state to help stabilize people who may be in crisis. And then we also have DQA, which is quality assurance for nursing home, long-term care, assisted living, et cetera. So it's a very large agency. And then in addition, we have our own legal counsel team. We have the Office of Inspector General to really look into fraud and abuse in many of our in programs that are operated out of DHS. But it's a very large agency. It's 6,400 staff.
Talking to Kirsten Johnson, Secretary Designee of the State Department of Health Services. You can join in with your questions about health and public health issues in Wisconsin at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Secretary Johnson, let's focus in now on some different aspects of health issues here in Wisconsin. I mentioned we had that DHS report on infant mortality rates, a big disparity, especially facing African Americans. Can you talk about what the DHS report found and what's driving some of those differences when it comes to infant mortality?
No, absolutely. This report wasn't surprising for any of us who've been working in this space for a long time. You know, and having come from the city of Milwaukee as a health commissioner, I know this data well, and it is really heartbreaking. But I think there are a number of factors that contribute: lack of access to care, disinvestment in our Black and Brown communities throughout the state. You know, pre-existing and chronic disease and racism and how it drives stress and the impact that it has on women during childbearing and when they're pregnant. So there's a number of factors that drive our really significant disparities around infant mortality in Wisconsin.
There are a lot of pieces to that puzzle. From the perspective of the state's Department of Health Services, what are some of your priorities to help tackle this problem?
Well, I think one of the things I was really excited about to see in the budget and hopeful was going to be included and was actually then cut was the postpartum coverage for Medicaid-eligible mothers for a full 12 months after delivery. It's currently 60 days in Wisconsin, where over 40 states have implemented or plan to implement in the coming months the full 12-month coverage. And Again, it was introduced in the budget and was cut out. I'm very hopeful that it will be going to be introduced as a bill and will pass the legislature. It has bipartisan support. I think that's the first step to getting women the coverage and access to care that they need and that really sort of vulnerable time in their lives after giving birth.
Let's stay with that state budget for a minute. What are some other things that you were happy to see make it through, items on your wish or hope list, maybe that didn't come through that you're hoping for future action on?
Sure. So I think, you know, overall, there were some great wins. Thinking about investments in safety net programs like food share, the increase in Medicaid reimbursement for our healthcare providers and healthcare partners and nursing homes, improving access to mental health and behavioral health care, investments in the healthcare workforce. I think those are all real wins and very meaningful for access to care in the state of Wisconsin. I think, again, like I mentioned, the lack of extension of postpartum coverage for Medicaid eligible mothers. I think the other, which is sort of, we all know this, but the lack of expansion of Medicaid, which left $1.6 billion in state savings on the table.
Let's focus in on the workforce end of things. We've had conversations here on Central Time over the years about, you know, not enough nurses to do things like home care, nursing home care, things like that, all the way to specialties not available, especially in rural parts of the state. What are some of your priorities when making sure that there are people to do the healthcare jobs that people need around the state?
Yeah, that's a good question. We've had many conversations internally and with many stakeholders about, you know, we can't make more people. So how do we incentivize the existing workforce to stay in the healthcare workforce? How do we potentially bring people back who may have left over the course of the pandemic? And then how do we engage our young people and make the healthcare workforce something that they're interested in doing? And, you know, we're looking at how do we increase base rates of pay? How do we potentially, you know, we have a number of pilot projects that exist out there right now with long-term care facilities. One, for example, which is paying people 5 days of for 5 days of work, but only working for 4 days. So again, trying to be creative in ways that we can encourage people to stay and come into the healthcare workforce. But it is absolutely a need, and especially with our aging workforce or aging population in Wisconsin.
Shifting to public health here. Now, one problem that I don't think anybody necessarily saw coming was having to have a public health reaction to wildfire smoke in Wisconsin, multiple days of public health advisories for ozone or particulate matter. Can you talk about the state response to that?
I can. You know, we like everyone, we've known about the wildfires that were happening in Canada. And, you know, part of this is just climate change and recognizing the vulnerability that we all are sitting in this space. But, you know, certainly when the smoke came in, I live in Milwaukee. You know, it's particularly thick early in the week here, working with the health departments, working internally with our comms team to figure out how do we message to people to stay inside. And if they do go outside, to mask. You know, lots of kids are in camps and are outdoors. So how do we work with, you know, all of our community partners and organizations that are working with our most vulnerable aging population, anyone who may have breathing issues? How do we assure that people have the information and access to their resources they need, like masks to wear outside? And unfortunately, I think this is something we're going to experience. I continue to experience over the course of this summer and future summers. So how do we address this long term is one of the questions we're asking ourselves.
Talking to Kirsten Johnson, Secretary Designee of the State Department of Health Services. She's with us for a look at a number of public health issues facing Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the issues we've already been talking about. If you work in healthcare, are there challenges getting enough people to work where you work in healthcare? Do you have thoughts on how you could bring more people in as either as CNAs or doctors or specialists in your community? Do you have trouble finding the kind of care you need in your part of the state? What would help you in future outbreaks of wildfire smoke here in Wisconsin? Let us know what you saw in your neck of the woods. And coming up, we're going to get a look at state efforts on the opioid epidemic and fentanyl in the state. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How is this affecting your community? Has it touched your family? If you work as a first responder or in healthcare, love to hear your perspective on the opioid epidemic here in the state. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Kirsten Johnson, recently appointed head of the state's Department of Health Services. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the many different things that department does, public health issues? What is important to you when it comes to public health, access to health care here in the state? And how have you seen the opioid epidemic, fentanyl and other opioids affect your community, your family, your work? If you work in healthcare, does your workplace have a kit on hand to deal with overdoses? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Secretary Johnson, a big public health issue, this opioid epidemic. Can you talk about some of the top priorities from your view at the state level?
Absolutely. I think our first priority at this point, I've been working in the opiate space since 2012 or 13, and we've come really a long way. And I think one of the things that we've been very successful about is just the stigma and being able to talk about it and being able to talk about what really works and what's the evidence that works for treatment. And so at this point within DHS, we're really heavily focused on harm reduction. And we recently funded a number of agencies to put out those vending machines that will have Narcan and fentanyl strips available in them. We are talking about other types of drugs that are coming onto the market, and what does the sort of looking beyond what we're handling right now, what potentially could be coming down the line. So are there other drugs that we are should be aware of, and how do we really look at that supply from the perspective of, what can we do to prevent more overdose and death and save families and communities from suffering from more loss?
Can you talk more about that idea of expanding access to Narcan, the anti-overdose, or some people have called it fentanyl poisoning, that the drug to help people survive that moment of overdose? Talk a little more about those vending machines and the hopes for them.
Sure. So there's a number of different initiatives. We have a program called Narcan Direct, and you can just go to the DHS website and look up Narcan Direct. But we have funded and are continuing to supply Narcan to public health agencies, police departments, fire departments, sheriff's departments, and other organizations that are working in the substance use space. So they have it on hand and can hand it out to family members and people who are using, so that they have it on hand in case they do overdose and their lives can be saved. So that's one really effective way of saving lives. And it's also a moment in time when potentially someone is more receptive to treatment. So again, looking at ways we can invest in the access to treatment. There's a new website resource available for Wisconsinites called Treatment Atlas through Shatterproof. It just started last week. It was kicked off last week, but anyone can go on and find treatment in Wisconsin near them that is evidence-based and effective.
I've also seen calls for more access to test strips. So if someone's using illegal drugs, which we don't want them doing in the first place, but if they are test strips so they can easily determine, hey, does this thing have some unexpected fentanyl in it? Is that something we're seeing more accessible around the state?
We are. So in addition to the Narcan, we are distributing fentanyl test strips, and those were also available in many of those same vending machines. And another conversation that we're starting, just starting, is thinking about, are there other test strips that we should make available, again, to potentially test for other substances that aren't as well known as fentanyl right now?
Can you talk about the various partners you're working with on the opioid and fentanyl crisis? You mentioned, getting the Narcan out, for example, to first responders and others. Who else are you hoping to keep at the table dealing with this issue?
I think we have a pretty great network, but we want to keep everyone at the table and continue to encourage partners to engage. So, like I mentioned, health departments and counties and municipalities, human services departments, nonprofits and organizations that provide substance use treatment or behavioral health treatment, physicians and our medical providers, pharmacies. I think anyone you can think of that could potentially touch someone's life who may be using a substance is someone that we want to have at the table. We have to be able to do this together. This is going to be a collective effort. I also think we need to do and have been doing a great job of of talking to people who are using to understand what are their needs, what would be most helpful for them, especially in the harm reduction space.
Dr. Kirsten Johnson, Secretary Designee of the State Department of Health Services, looking at many health and public health issues facing the state. Still time for you to join in if you have a question or response to what you've heard at 800-642-1234, a personal experience related to the opioid crisis, someone in your family, your community, maybe you've provided Narcan to someone yourself in the line of work. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. On the issue of the healthcare workforce, we heard from Greg and Mequon, who couldn't stay on the line but wants to know whether there will be anything for healthcare workers and paid sick time. Greg says many healthcare workers do not have adequate sick time. Is that part of that workforce retention issue we were talking about earlier, Secretary Johnson?
Absolutely. And this is actually, I think, something that came up during the pandemic. We learned quite quickly early on that people were going to work because they had to, because they didn't have time off and they didn't have paid sick time. So I think it's critically important that we reexamine how we support our workforce, especially when, you know, we all have lives and people get sick. And we certainly know this after the last 3 years, and they need that space and time to heal and to make sure that they're taking care of themselves. And absolutely, thinking about what are those more robust ways we can support the workforce is critical, and sick time is absolutely one of them. Paid time off.
Thanks for sharing that comment, Greg. And, you know, post-COVID, I know I've seen, at least in other states, concerns that, you know, the COVID experience drove some people out of healthcare, the public response, the burnout, the strain. Is that a part of the story here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely, it is. I think we've lost in the state of Wisconsin almost half of the health officials and that run public health departments. And myself being one, it was absolutely exhausting. Nobody gets into healthcare or public health everyone gets into it because they care about people and they want to make sure that people can live their healthiest and best lives. And when the pandemic happened, we became the targets of vitriol and anger. And I think a lot of it was driven by fear, but that is a really hard place to be. You end up with moral injury when you took on a role or you've taken on a career because you really care about people and you want to do what's right. I think it's been hard for everyone, myself included. I'm hopeful that many of the people who've taken a step away come back because the work is so meaningful and, you know, we need them.
Let's bring in a caller now on the opioid epidemic. Beth is with us in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Beth, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Beth?
Oh, I just wanted to mention about the fentanyl test strips that I had purchased some for free from Warp Corp in a town near us here. And I didn't think my son would use them, but he informed me a few weeks ago that he did, in fact, use them to test some illegal drugs that he had purchased. And, you know, they didn't have fentanyl in them. So I was glad that I got them. I just wanted to say that.
Thanks. Not every parent would go out and do that for their kid. What led you to go out and pick those up?
Well, I was obviously concerned about him. He had overdosed during COVID, not necessarily from fentanyl, but I didn't know what he might come across later. So I've had him for a few years, and he knew where they were, and he went and he took the initiative to do it.
Beth, thanks a lot for that call. And Secretary Johnson, and good luck to your son, by the way, Beth. Secretary Johnson, you know, people have mixed feelings about these strips. Probably rather the son, in this case, not use the illegal drugs in the first place. Talk about the harm reduction element in that, please.
Absolutely. And Beth, thank you for sharing your story. I think it's so important as parents. I'm a parent of a 17-year-old son, to have very honest conversations with our kids. And all of us, their children are not using, but we'd also really like to have our children with us. And any way we can avoid injury or death, I think, is a path that is completely acceptable. And there should be no shame associated with it. And we have to do what's best for our kids. And if meeting them in the middle is making sure that they are using a substance safely, that's where we need to meet them. And certainly no parent wants that. But, mm-hmm. You know, kudos to Beth for making sure her son is safe.
Beth, thanks for the call. Ashley is with us now in Milwaukee. Ashley, hi.
Hi. I've never called in before, so this is a little weird for me. But I thank you for taking my call. And I did catch the show late, but I wanted to share that I was an IV drug user, heroin user, for over 10 years, and I'm now living in recovery. I have a year and a half. I'm actually driving to my job at a recovery center where I work. And I wanted to share something about the fentanyl test strips, because they hand those out at the needle exchange, right? And it's interesting, because I would get, you know, my heroin from like 8 different sources, and all of them had fentanyl in it. It wasn't an option to not have fentanyl-free dope. And what the strips don't do is test the amount of fentanyl that's in there. And I just think it's important to say out loud that, like, always know there's fentanyl in the heroin. There's not no fentanyl in heroin.
Ashley, thanks. I'm sorry, we're just about out of time. I'm so glad you're in recovery. Secretary Johnson, some firsthand experience there in our last few moments.
Thank you for sharing that, Ashley. I think it's really important and a really important point.
Thanks for that call. Secretary Johnson, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Been talking to Kirsten Johnson, Secretary Designee of the State Department of Health Services, looked at a wide variety of issues facing public health here in Wisconsin. If you have questions on these health issues that you'd like to see the whole conversation about, let us know. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, Barbecue Hall of Famer Meathead joins us again for Food Friday. This time, we're going to focus in on barbecuing chicken. You can get things started right now. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page with your questions, maybe your favorites, your number one successes or failures when it comes to grilling chicken. That's Food Friday coming up. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin has a new state budget after months of wrangling and a bunch of key vetoes. We'll find out what the future holds for education, taxes, and more. Now it's summer cookout season, and after a 4th of July weekend of burgers, hot dogs, and brats, you might be ready for something different on the grill at your next backyard barbecue. Well, good news, it's Food Friday. We're going to learn all the best practices and recipes for great barbecue chicken. From choosing what we want to make, the recipes, the sauces and seasons, cooking it all through without getting too dry or overdone. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you like to barbecue chicken? Do you have a favorite recipe, method, spice, sauce? What's the best way to do chicken on the grill? Or do you need some advice? Do you have some questions you need answered? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Meathead is back with us, food writer, founder of AmazingRibs.com. In 2021, he was inducted into the American Royal Barbecue Hall of Fame. He's the author of the book Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. Meathead, welcome back.
Rob, always good to talk to you.
Now, where does chicken fit into the barbecue world? Does it get respect, or is everybody like, no, it's the pork and the ribs and the steaks and stuff like that?
You know, I think ribs is everybody's all-time favorite barbecue, but they're a little tricky. And, you know, chicken is the number one protein in this country, so everybody grills chicken, and it poses some problems. It is not the easiest thing.
Now, if I said, Meathead, I'm showing up in an hour and a half, make some chicken on the grill, if I could just do that, what would be your go-to? What is your, like, okay, I'm grilling, I'm going to do some chicken. What is your number one way to do it?
Well, always set up the grill in two zones, whether it's gas or charcoal. You want to have a hot side and a not hot side, especially with chicken. Chicken has skin on it that is mostly fat. And if you put it over a direct flame, it's going to blacken and it's going to burn before the inside is cooked, before the inside is safe. And you need to make sure the interior is cooked to a safe temperature. In 2014, Consumer Reports did a test. They bought 300 chicken breasts and found that 90% of them had pathogenic bacteria. Now, that's nothing to worry about. If you cook them to 160 to 165 degrees, that kills them all. You always, always cook with a thermometer, not a clock. If you're working with a recipe that says 15 minutes on this side, 10 minutes on that side, It's malpractice. Go out and this is 2023. Digital thermometers are fantastic. They'll give you a precision reading in 5 seconds or less. And you can get a really good one for $30 or less. Go get one if you don't have one.
I got to say, I used to cook without a meat thermometer. And my chicken is so much better since I started using it. Because my strategy was, I'm going to err on the side of cooking it too long to make sure I kill all those pathogens. Now, the meat thermometer, I cook it just right. We could hammer this point home. They're not expensive, right?
No. AmazingRibs.com, my website, hired an electrical engineer to test digital thermometers. We don't sell any of them, but we have over 200 reviews of digital thermometers and links from where you can buy them. Amazon, of course, carries a huge selection. Take a look at our reviews. Pick one that fits your price range. You can spend $100 and get a really great one that gives you a precision reading in 1 or 2 seconds. But $16 to $30 will get you one that'll give you a good reading in 5 seconds. And it's precise. If you have an old dial thermometer in your junk drawer in the kitchen, take it out, put it in your driveway, and back your car over it. It's a piece of junk.
They're pointy, though. I don't want to blow up my tire. All right, now let's talk about, let's go with the whole chicken, first of all. What is the best? Well, actually, let's talk about a way not to cook a whole chicken here. You've got a big rant on this. You were an evangelist in this crusade here on the beer can chicken. It's popular. It's popular on the internet. You don't like it. Why?
Well, it always tastes great because it's roast chicken. Roast chicken always tastes great, but the beer can has nothing to do with it. First of all, the beer inside the can can't evaporate. If you're cooking it to a safe temperature, 160 to 165, beer boils at 212. You're 30, 40, 50 degrees below the boiling temperature of the beer. It doesn't escape. And even if it did escape, it would only contact a very small amount of the meat near the top of the shoulder. It can't travel. There's no interstate highway in the chicken where the beer flavor will somehow go all the way down to the legs. And when you pull it out, the interior, the cavity, is tan. And you want brown. You want golden. That's flavor. So it doesn't add any flavor. And besides, do you really want chicken to taste like beer? It just has, it looks cool. The chicken tastes fine, but it doesn't work the way you think it does. I prefer to cut the chicken into parts. I don't even cook the chicken whole anymore because dark meat is different than white meat. And actually, dark meat is best, I think, at around 170. So if you cut the chicken up, you can cook each part using your digital thermometer to precisely the optimum temperature and serve everybody really tender, really juicy, really flavorful chicken. If you cook the whole thing, you end up making compromise. Either you undercook one the legs or you overcook the breast. I like to cut them up.
Same thing for Thanksgiving, because that's my experience with the Thanksgiving turkey. Some of it's too done, some of it's barely done.
Yeah, that's a problem. What controls doneness, and a lot of people don't understand this, is the thickness of the meat. So a chicken breast is a lot thicker than a chicken wing, and it takes a lot longer to cook than a chicken thigh or a chicken drumstick. So, and the same thing with turkey. The thickness determines the cooking time. So if you cut it up, you can cook each piece to ideally the optimum temperature. And I hate to say it, I do it with my Thanksgiving turkey as well. But I get much better food on the table.
It is Food Friday. We are grilling chicken with Meathead. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite way of cooking chicken on the grill? A favorite rub or sauce? Or a question for Meathead, join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. James on Facebook takes us into the sauce world, Meathead. James says, Alabama-style white sauce is where it's at. There's a great barbecue joint in Menominee, Michigan that has a white sauce that pairs nicely with their pulled chicken. Meathead, sauces, what do you like?
Yeah, you know, he's onto something there. Many people don't know about it.
When
we think about barbecue sauce, we always think about that red stuff, which we call Kansas City style. and it's rich, thick, sweet. It's great on chicken. But down in Alabama, northern Alabama, particularly started at Big Bob Gibson's restaurant in Decatur, Alabama, they make a sauce. It's kind of like it's a mustard base. It's I got the recipe on AmazingRibs.com, and it's really tasty. They dunk the bird into a vat of it, and it really works nicely. For me, I prefer the French, you know, they learned how to cook a long time ago. They use a lot of herbs on their poultry, and I have an herb rub, poultry rub that we sell, and a recipe for it on AmazingRibs.com. But it's mostly green. It's mostly herbs and a little bit of spices, and it really works beautifully with chicken. That's my favorite. But a lot of people like to go with your standard barbecue rub, which is loaded with garlic and onion powder and paprika, and that works well too. Chicken is really a blank canvas. You can put a lot of different flavors on it, and they come out right. And, you know, something crossed my mind while we were at break there. If you break the chicken up and cook it in parts, you get to brown it on all sides. When you cook the chicken whole, the cavity doesn't get brown. Mm-hmm. It just is light tan. But brown is beautiful. Brown is a chemical reaction called the Maillard reaction. It's when proteins and amino acids change due to the heat. And brown is flavor, and that's what you want. When you break the bird up, you can brown all sides.
Now, I want to talk about when the sauce goes on. We're reverse searing, right? We're heating it on the, you know, indirect side, finishing it on the hot side. When do I put the sauce on? Sometimes I put it on too early. It caramelizes, burns in ways they don't like. What's the timing on our sauces?
Well, I'm gonna back you up here because you know how to cook, and that's one of the reasons.
Thanks
to you,
Meathead, I literally cook chicken reverse sear because of you.
Yeah, well, okay, but you know how to do that. How many times have we all gone to a party where the chicken is just beautiful, golden, maybe a little browning, blackening on the outside, and you cut into it and it's red and raw and undercooked? That happens all the time. The technique to prevent that is what you just said, and it's called reverse sear. At the top of the show, I mentioned you want to divide your grill in half, a hot side and a not hot side. You have all the coals on one side or all the burners on one side. The other side, no coals, no burners. And you start the chicken on the no burner, no coal side. It's called the indirect heat zone. When you close the lid, hot air circulates over there via convection airflow, and it will warm the chicken gently and evenly. It takes longer over there because it's not directly over flame or glowing coals. They produce infrared energy, and that's intense. This is conduction energy, and it's gentle. But what it does is it cooks the chicken perfectly on the inside. The problem is when the chicken hits about 150, remember our target's 160. When the chicken hits about 150, the skin is still flabby. It's still rubbery. And when it hits about 150, then you take it and you move it over that infrared energy, that hot coals, the flames from your gas grill, skin side down, and it turns golden and it gets crispy, and you know it's cooked to a safe temperature inside because you're using a digital thermometer. And that's a technique that Rob mentioned called reverse sear, and it is absolutely the best way to do chicken.
And I jumped ahead a little bit. Now, where do we put the sauce on?
I forgot that was the question.
I was too far ahead. We needed to talk reverse sear first.
You want to get the skin crisp first. If you put the sauce on before the skin is crispy, the skin's going to still stay soggy. Put the sauce on the last 5 or 10 minutes, and you don't need 10 layers of sauce. I did ribs this 4th of July, 10 slabs of ribs, one coat. That's all. It was delicious. One thin coat. When you don't put too much sauce on, you get to taste the chicken. You get to taste the rub. You get to taste the natural flavors from the smoke and the charcoal and everything. So one coat of sauce just in the last few minutes, and you put it on and put it over the direct heat, but stand there with the lid open. Watch it like a hawk, mm-hmm. because it will go from beautiful color to burnt to a crisp in a hurry, because most sauce has sugar in it, and you don't want to burn it. You want to caramelize it gently.
We're talking to Barbecue Hall of Famer Meathead, founder of AmazingRibs.com. We're barbecuing chicken on this edition of Food Friday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your go-to way of barbecuing chicken? Is there a method that works best for you? Need some advice on how to take your barbecue chicken to the next level? Has something gone wrong? Do you need a solution? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Meathead. He's a food writer who founded AmazingRibs.com, a member of the Barbecue Hall of Fame. He's with us today with recipes and advice for great barbecue chicken. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about grilling chicken? What are the best ways you've found to keep that chicken moist and flavorful? Do you have a favorite rub or sauce? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls. Chad is with us in La Crosse. Chad, hi.
Hello, this is Chad in La Crosse. I have a question for you. I wondered if you ever used the technique of using boiling water to break down the chicken skin prior to grilling.
So you pre-boil the chicken thighs, just like a quick, parboil or something, Chad?
Yeah, I saw it once in Amazing, but I've never done it.
Interesting. Meathead, is that something you recommend?
I've never, well, first of all, water is a solvent. That's why we wash our hands with it. So I don't want to dunk meat into water. I wouldn't put a steak in water or a chicken in water. People like to boil their ribs. When you take them out, the water is brown. That's flavor that you can't get back in. But steaming chicken skin can help break down the connective tissues. There's a lot of collagen in there, but I have tested it and it does work. I have not found it necessary. Hot infrared energy does a great job of making chicken skin crisp and crunchy. And we talked a little bit ago, I hope you were listening, about reverse sear. If you warm that chicken gently on the indirect side and then finish it skin side down over the infrared, you'll get good crispy skin. If you want a little baking soda, very little on the surface, will accelerate the browning and the crispiness. Steaming it might help a little bit. Don't boil it. I don't find it terribly necessary.
Chad, thanks a lot for the call. Marty joins us now in Milwaukee. Marty, hi.
Hi. My method for cooking a chicken outside is I bought one of these electric smokers. One of these, it has like one of these water bowls on the bottom of it. You know, you've probably seen them, but I don't use the water. It has like two racks in it, and I usually, you know, fill both the racks with thighs, you know, darker meat. And I don't really have to even watch it or anything. I just put the cover on and everything and just let it go. And sometimes I put a little bit of charcoal onto the heating element that's on the bottom. It kind of makes it, helps it smoke a little bit. But the dripping of the chicken makes a lot of smoke anyway, you know. And I just let it go for about 4.5-5 hours. It comes out really moist, and I don't know, it's probably kind of well done or whatever because it shrinks down a lot. But I don't know. I like it.
Marty, thanks a lot for the call. Meathead, electric smokers for our chicken.
Well, chicken does like smoke. So does turkey. But it can overdo it. Too much smoke, I think, is a mistake on chicken. Now, electric smokers are a special breed. They're my least favorite because there's no combustion in there. And so there's no combustion gases. And the best smoke flavor comes from combustion gases. But the advantage of electric smokers is it's a sealed environment. So it's really good at holding in moisture. I think if your listener would get himself a good digital thermometer and watch the temperature of that chicken, he might find that it's done in 2 hours and it's really much more juicy. Electric smokers are great at delivering juicy meat. So I would recommend the less smoke. He's onto an interesting trick, and that is putting a charcoal briquette in on the heating element of an electric smoker. that produces some combustion gases, particularly nitric oxide, which is responsible for making the smoke ring, which is a thin pink layer, which you see on classically smoked barbecue. And if you want that smoke ring, a little charcoal on an electric smoker will help you get there.
Marty, thanks a lot for that call. It's Food Friday, talking to Meathead, founder of AmazingRibs.com. We are grilling chicken. Back to your calls. Diane is with us in Norwalk. Diane, hi.
Hi. I have a question about using a thermometer. I have noticed that when I stick it into the piece of meat, the juices run out the hole. And I'm wondering if there are some techniques that I could use that would help me save the juices in that piece of meat.
Interesting question. I've wondered that myself sometimes, Meathead.
Not to worry. That piece of chicken is 75% water. Those juices are water that's coming out. If you have an 8-ounce piece of chicken breast and you stick it with a thermometer, a few drops of water is barely going to reduce the moisture in there at all. You can stick it all you want, a dozen times. If you lose a tablespoon, there's 6 ounces of water left in there. That's a lot of water. You won't lose more. In fact, the cooking process loses more water just due to evaporation and what we call drip loss. It drips, and a lot of that stuff comes out through the bottom, lands on the coals, and evaporates back up and gives it flavor. Don't worry about it. Poke it all you want. The temperature is really crucial. You're not going to lose much moisture. There's plenty of moisture in there. And by the way, all that moisture is mostly water with a little bit of fat. It doesn't harm a thing.
Diane, thanks a lot for the call. Hey, Meathead, I want to take a couple minutes. People maybe want to do the buffalo wings experience at home. Now, that's classically deep fried. I don't want to deep fry stuff at home. How close can I get grilling my wings in a buffalo fashion?
Oh, my gosh. You just opened up a wonderful door. Everybody loves fried chicken. Everybody who likes fried chicken, raise your hand. All your listeners got their hands up, I can see. You don't fry chicken in your house very often because it makes smoke. It spatters all over the cooktop and the counters. It's just a mess. You're not going to buy this at first, but you got to think about it. If you have a gas grill or even a charcoal grill, get a Dutch oven, put an inch or so of oil in there, and fry your chicken outdoors. Who cares if it smokes outdoors? Who cares if it spatters? It's not a risk. It's not going to catch on fire. You're not going to knock the Dutch oven over. It's heavy. And even if you do, the worst that happens is you're going to lose a $500 grill. You knock that Dutch oven over on your stovetop and you lose your $500,000 home. Now, do it outdoors on your grill. Set up in two zones. You've got a hot zone on one side and no heat on the other side. You bring the oil up to 375. That's your magic temperature. About 2 inches of oil is all you want. You want the chicken to actually touch the hot middle at the bottom of the pan. That's the way it was always done in the South in a cast iron frying pan. We're doing it in a Dutch oven instead of a frying pan because the high sides contain more of the spattering and the boiling and the stuff. And you're going to get unbelievably good fried chicken, and you don't have to worry about any of the cleanup. When the chicken is done, and you'll know because you have your digital thermometer, you take it out and you put it on the grill in the zone where there's no heat. And when you close the lid, it'll just stay there and stay warm. So you can fry your chicken in batches. You don't want to crowd the pot. You don't, because when you add cold chicken to boiling oil, it knocks the temperature from 375 all the way down to 300.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it. Thanks to Meathead for joining us today. Food writer, founder of AmazingRibs.com, author of Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling, with us today on Food Friday to help us improve our barbecue chicken for the summer grilling season. Keep sharing your favorites, your advice, maybe your recipes over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.